Wonderful. Well, it's great to see all of you. And really excited that we have a chance to come together as a community, which we don't often have. So maybe that's a silver lining of this crazy situation that we're in. But we certainly need it. I know for myself, and I've heard from so many people. But before we sort of go into, you know, I have some things I want to share with you, and I want to also interact and hear from you and where you are and what you might want or need right now. But first, let's just a little bit of technical, sort of the technical orientation. I don't know, for those of you who are not familiar with Zoom, you come in muted, and then you can unmute yourself, but I would prefer, since there's so many of us, that you use a function called the hand raise. And you can access that function by going to your bottom toolbar with your, you can try it right now, going to your bottom toolbar with your cursor, clicking on it, and you'll see to the right, there's a panel opens, and at the bottom, you should find something that says raise hand, a little clicker. So that's how you raise your hand. And I believe and I hope that when you do that, when we get to the point where we're in more of discussion mode, that I'll be able to see you and I'll unmute you and we can hear from you. Okay. The other thing that you might want to know is that if you want to just see the person who's speaking, myself or whoever is speaking at the moment, up in the right of the upper toolbar, you'll see an option for speaker view or gallery view, right? So gallery view is like the Brady Bunch where you can see everybody. Speaker view is where you'll just see the person who's speaking. So whichever you prefer, up to you, okay? So I think that's for now our sort of practical orientation. And I just, you know, I have a few thoughts and reflections that I want to share with you. I apologize because I didn't disable my sound. I don't know if you can hear the little bells as I get email. I apologize. Tom is going to scold me and give me a little whack, and hopefully he'll help me figure out how to disable that sound. Anyway, at least it's a nice little bell sound. So I have a few little some just general comments and reflections after it's been a couple of weeks. I think most of us have been more or less quarantined. You know, let's talk a little bit about, I have some thoughts about what we might all be struggling with and how we might really try to take the most advantage or make the best out of the situation given what it is. The first thing that I remarked on and just really looking at this crisis is just how it seems like our whole lives have just ground to a halt. And we have this very, very, you know, highly, you just realize by contrast how highly complicated and how striving and distracting our lives are, right? And to have all of that suddenly just stopped, I mean, how often has that happened? And how often has it happened on such a global scale? It's sort of just sobering and gives you, by contrast, a sense of, you know, how we can spend so much of our lives caught up in the flow of all of that distraction and striving and busyness. So, you know, we, for better or for worse, we have this opportunity to really reflect on what, you know, what are the basics of our lives. In fact, we're sort of reduced to the fundamentals. We're really sort of reduced to the basic facts of our life. Am I infected? Am I not infected? How do I not get infected? Who do I know, who I love, I'm concerned about? Who am I hearing about as well or not? What kind of food can I eat? You know, where can I go? We're really brought to very basic, bare bones reality. And the bottom line of that, sort of the common denominator of all of that, is a sort of a powerful, poignant realization of just how vulnerable we all are. You know, not just as, you know, whether we happen to be in a high risk or a lowest population, a hot spot or a cool spot, but just because we all know that this is a serious and highly contagious little bit of RNA, that as a form of life, we're really so vulnerable. We're like permeable and open in every way. And we can feel that not just on the level of our own physical body, but sort of as a species, regardless, cutting across all the differences that seem to be so glaring normally, we're all so vulnerable. I'm reminded of the you probably remember this, what Ogden Nash, I think, the childhood poet who wrote the poem, "A Mighty Creature is the Germ," right? So really, but also another way to look at it is we're all so vulnerable and we're all so delicate and our lives are so delicately balanced. Isn't it amazing that this kind of thing doesn't happen all the time? Let's pray not. So here we are facing our vulnerability, and the first thing we notice about that is it's not easy. It is not easy for us to sit with ourselves without all of the distractions, without all of the striving, without all of the busyness, the complexity. It's really hard for us to get through the day in a way that is quite unique and different. I believe it has to do with the fact that we really have to face ourselves kind of in a primal existential way. So why is that? I mean, on the very simple level, it's because we're all aware there's an illness out there that's poses an imminent risk, right? And faces us all with the reality of death. And whether we personally ourselves feel at risk of dying, or we just know that many people that we hear about or many people around us are, that's not so common that we get that very personal reminder. And it's also very rare that we get it in this en masse, in this collective memo from life. So that's really powerful. And you know, I believe, however, that there's a less obvious reason why we all feel so uncomfortable right now. You know, I think it has, whether we're sort of frontline health workers going into the hospital, whether we're providing a critical service and, you know, out there filling people's needs, or whether we're, you know, in the quarantined majority, taking care of loved ones, neighbors, friends, we're all stripped of our familiar routines and distractions, and we're forced to face and feel ourselves. Right? We're just for, and in that sense, it's really sort of like a great forced worldwide retreat, right? And ironically, of course, the retreat leaders have no idea when we're going to get out of it, right? So it's a real retreat, or what things are going to be like when the crisis passes, at least for those of us who are lucky enough to get to the other side of it. So it's very real and existential. It's sort of like a bardo, and you used to use the Tibetan term, a transition between you know, one state of being and another. It really feels like that kind of existential transition of what is it, what form is my life gonna take on the other side of this? Again, assuming that we're lucky enough to survive. So since I started practicing, to some extent when I was 18, I was very fortunate in my first religion class at college to be down the end of the table from Bob Thurman, with his wild yellow hair, his one eye, his one glass eye, and raving about tantric Buddhism, with the first class, Yamantaka, Vajrayogini, all of these sort of esoteric things to a bunch of undergraduates. So of course I was immediately hooked. And several years later, I found myself traveling to India with him, and getting an initiation in a esoteric practice from his teacher, the former Venerable Ling Rinpoche, the former head of the Gelug tradition. It was an amazing experience. But the one thing, of course, that for any of you who have had the experience of getting what we call an unexcelled yoga tantra or highest yoga tantra, or if you've just been to the Rubin Museum, you've seen the mandalas. You basically imagine yourself in that context in a one-room house, basically. I mean, some of them are a little bit more than a one-room house, but they're basically like a one-room house. And you're in there with your spiritual family, and you're kind of quarantined, and you're gonna stay there. The meditation is you're gonna stay there the way the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree until you realize enlightenment. That's the place where you're gonna realize enlightenment. That's the metaphor. Now outside, very nicely, there's some beautiful gardens and some yard, and then there's a big fence and a firewall. And on the other side of the firewall, there are cremation grounds. And in the cremation grounds, you can see through the firewall, and you can see that everything out there is falling apart, and everyone is falling apart, right? So that's kind of, for me, a metaphor, natural metaphor for the situation we're in. It is kind of like we're facing this reality. We may be in a bubble of safety, or we may not be. We may just have the bubble of our own reflective awareness, but we are facing the reality of our mortality, and also the impermanence and the volatility of our whole way of being, our whole civilization, right out there. And it's not an easy place to sit. It's not an easy place to have a presence of mind or to feel anything other than a little bit paralyzed or overwhelmed. If we're lucky, we have some habit of reflection or practice, right? I think most of us are here on this Zoom or in the part of this community because we are inclined in that way. And we may have a regular practice of some kind, or at least we may have a feeling for what that might be like, right? And perhaps we're aware that part of that, the philosophy of practice is to turn adversity to advantage. It's to take, not wait until, the conditions are ideal, but to take the present reality, the present situation as an opportunity, however adverse it seems or however difficult. So we might be ready to turn this extended retreat into a real retreat, right? So, and it may mean that we have to do our daily work, our caring for others, our tending to the exigencies of daily life. But we can also weave in a very unique way. We can take advantage of this existential bardo that we're in to really try to make a little headway in the most important thing in life, which is, can we face ourselves? Can we live with ourselves? Can we live well in our own body and with others, our bodies connected to others? So we may have enough study or practice to have some idea of what our retreat agenda should be. Right, and maybe you can reflect on that now, or you've already maybe reflected on it. What should we be meditating on if we're sitting here, we have this time? And of course, those of you who know anything about Tibetan Buddhism know that it revolves around something called the gradual path, the Patakrama or Lam Rim in Tibetan, which is a way of kind of, like a grammar school or a sneaky way of feeding ourselves the things that we really, the most important things we need to reflect on. And of course we start from how precious our human lives are, right? So that's an easy one. We can so feel, and I'm a therapist most of the time or whatever, a significant amount of the time. And I spend a lot of time nowadays on Zoom hearing people talking. And it's remarkable how so many of the problems that we normally talk about just pale in comparison. And particularly, I've had a lot of people talking about how grateful they are, going from complaining about their spouse, like if it's couples therapy, to thinking, how lucky am I to have a partner, or complaining about whatever, how lucky am I to be alive. So that's one natural meditation. And of course, right after it, there's the how quickly everything can change, how ever present death is. because of the very nature of the game, of the fabric of life that we're part of. And then comes the sobering reality, how prepared or unprepared is our wild mind to face that, to face death, or to face, in other words, death as a symbol too, or an indicator of our being present, vulnerable in this moment with a body that feels and with a mind that feels. So, you know, of course it's vital. The main end of all of this reflection is usually, what do we take refuge in? Right? If we know that we're vulnerable, it's a precious opportunity, we don't really know how to tame our own minds. This is what, as they say, turns the mind to the teaching or practice, because it sort of helps us understand that we need some help, guidance. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. Even the Buddha had teachers. And that's where we might have a sense of refuge, that something that seems a reliable method or a way to bring relief or real freedom that isn't just temporary, you know, distraction, and that maybe even has the promise of loosening the grip, the vice grip of stress and trauma that's locking our heart and locking our brain and locking us into this mode of not finding it so easy to breathe, right? How do we unlock that vice grip? As Bob Thurman likes to say, compare the heart knot, the part of us that is where we feel often most easily how gripped we are by our survival mode, or as some like to say, our negativity bias. You know, he compares it to what would happen if you found out that, you know, as you were born, somebody left a clamp on your heart by accident. And suddenly, you know, somehow you had an x-ray and you found out it was there, and you were able to take it off, right? So that's what we want, is to be able to bear being in our bodies with some curiosity, openness, freedom. How do we get there? How do we take that vice grip off of our hearts? So I would like to share with you one agenda that I, one retreat agenda that I use. Most of you know me as a teacher, like a Buddhist teacher. Some of you know me as a therapist. But I also wear another hat, and it's also a beret though. I only have berets. And that is, I teach a group. I run groups for breast cancer survivors at Cornell, at Weill Cornell. And in the context there, I have people that are really mostly not at all familiar with the Dharma or with meditation. They're just people who are familiar with an existential threat, who feel like we do, that our lives are really that a lot more in our face, and maybe, you know, feel overwhelmed by that or isolated by that. And I teach a practice that's called compassion-based resilience training. Right? And it's a practice that basically is, you know, culls together some of the principles from the gradual path into a more secular format of reflection and meditation. Right? And it's based on 8 modules. So let me share with you, again, maybe a very, very abbreviated version of what those, God, is it already 6:05? Wow, okay. An abbreviated version of what those modules are, okay? And that may, some one or the other of them may stir something for you, I hope. So the first one I can maybe encapsulate as, in terms of suffering, what do we do with suffering, with distress, with trauma? We face it, right? This is the hardest thing to do. Our instincts tell us to fight it, to run from it, to blot it out. What would happen if we just face it and we practice facing it, right? And ironically, as I was just talking to one of my clients today, whose business may be imploding, and who is saying, you know, I'm okay with it today. because I'm grateful to be alive. And, you know, it was very stressful anyway. And what a relief if I can just face that as a potential. I lived years running this business, worrying myself to death that it wasn't going to work. And now in this context, I feel like I can just say, okay, well, so it might not work, but I can face that and I can bear with it. And what a huge relief. So he was talking about that sense of relief he had just by facing what we always tend to run from or fight with or push away, right? So that's the first thing. And that's where the body mindfulness that we began is the skill that we teach as a training for that. And I think all of us who have some experience of mindfulness practice, you know, it's a simple and accessible way to, you know, to be with whatever is, rather than allow our super complicated virtual reality generators that we call brains to weave all kinds of narratives and alternatives and, so, you know, escape routes and so on, to just try the extremely ridiculously simple but not obvious step of facing it. And why do we have so much trouble facing? Because we have to feel it if we face it, right? We do have to feel it. And if we're not practiced, you know, feeling and bearing with what it is that we're facing, it can feel like death. It can feel worse than death. And we can be running from this. And we've talked in other programs that talked a lot about some of the feelings that we spend our lives running from, like shame or panic or rage or resentment. But certainly that's part of the path here, as in therapy, is to really understand that if we face it, it's the path, it's the only way through it, right? So this, and the second point I recommend, I sort of thought I could encapsulate as we can bear with it, right? We can learn to bear with our suffering. In one of the traditions of practice, many of you may know the mind training, the 7-point mind training practice. That is a compassion practice, a compassion training practice. It's what I would call an industrial strength compassion training practice, because it's really a little more intense and rigorous than loving kindness, which is the foundation of it. There's a great pithy statement. It's a practice made of collected pithy statements, so it's kind of easy to learn. And that is, tolerate both, whatever comes. All right, so meaning tolerate both good and bad, whatever it is, tolerate it. Now, why would you need to tolerate the good? Right, you can see why we need to tolerate the bad, but why do we need to tolerate the good? Because normally we don't spend any time just being with and bearing with what we're experiencing. We're normally living, you know, several feet from our bodies and our embodied experience. So again, whether we, you know, whatever it is that's coming up, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or seems boring, that's the second kind of pointer that we might want to reflect on, is how do I bear with this? How can I bear with what I'm feeling better or more fully, or, you know, just put more effort into it? And then there's a practice of mindful sensitivity, which is one of the four basic mindfulness practices that can train us to do that, learning how to watch ourselves overreacting to any feeling and try to soften that overreaction and slowly shift it into a space, a bearing with, then that bearing with can lead to a responsiveness. So what that does, right, stopping the and facing our suffering means that we're not adding anymore. We're not continuing to amount the debt, right? We're not borrowing even more on our lives, postponing the reality of facing who we are and what it's like to feel alive. In this case, we're not only stopping to face it, but we're stopping the mechanism that generates our suffering, which is our mindless reactivity. Like this is the stress reactive mind, the mind that doesn't want to stop and wait and see if something is harmful or if I can live with it or bear it, wants to quickly get rid of it and jump over it or run away from it. That mind that is, that we're wired, that's our default mind, helped us survive as little creatures for so long, now keeps us stuck in negativity mode, in survival mode, because it's so good at reacting to what we're feeling that we don't feel it. We barely feel it. We're just a big, one big reaction. So here's where we sort of slow that wheel or that mechanism of reactivity and by bearing with what is before we have time to react, and then hence trying to learn the art of responding instead, right, of bringing awareness into how we respond. So then what's next, right? So we faced our suffering, or we're maybe thinking about trying to face our suffering. We're trying to bear with whatever it is, good, bad, or neutral. And the next, I think, is learning how to see through it, right? Because part of our suffering isn't, it's more than it's cracked, you know, it's not, most suffering is not as much as it's cracked up to be. Our minds are, again, our negativity, our stress-based, fear-based minds want to jump to the worst case. And once they've jumped to the worst case, they etch it in stone. That's, I call it reification, right? That is to say, we're taking something that was just an experience and we're making it a real, seem like a reality. We're giving everything way too much weight. And so we can't see through it because it seems so solid. Well, this is really awful. How am I going to get through this? Right? How do I, you know, how can I bear with this? How can I feel it? This is going to, you know, end me or ruin me or kill me or asphyxiate me or whatever it's going to do, annihilate me. And part of that is actually this extra kind of oomph of surreal, excessive reality that we put into things that makes them opaque and we can't see through them. We put into our suffering, we etch it in stone just by the way we objectify it, basically, the way we kind of label it, objectify it, and solidify it. So in this practice, we use open awareness. And those, I think most of you who've done any mindfulness practice, we had maybe a few moments of it. This is where we open the mind. We're not focusing on either breath or sensation. We're focusing on just awareness. And the purpose of that is to kind of stretch our awareness capacity. And mostly, more than stretching, it's to make it Teflon, to unstick it, that it's like flypaper. Our awareness is like flypaper, and everything that we think or feel lands on it and gets stuck to it. And then it's kind of like we have very little awareness because it's like our minds are all like stuck to the flypaper, right? And so this open awareness practice is a way of unsticking our minds. And when we can unstick our minds, then we can take that step back. Psychologists call this metacognition. It's watching our minds at work or knowing how we know, observing how it is that we know, what it is that we're knowing. And when we can step back in that way, then we can really, we have freshness. We have a kind of primal curiosity or primal awareness that is much more powerful, because it's not limited. Our normal capacity for attention or awareness is like spread out over all the little bits of flypaper that we're stuck to. So there's very little to learn anything because it's all committed. It's all bound up in conclusions. And so when we unstick it, we have this capacity for like we're just babies again. Our minds are in their natural phase. We can see things that we normally wouldn't see, and we can see through the solidity that we've imposed on our suffering. We can see that it's just a form of suffering. It may just be a temporary pattern, or it may be something that we need to work at, okay? So that's the seeing through that we need to do to really start to work on our suffering. because we can't work on it as long as we hold it to be so real. It just becomes unwieldy and immovable. Okay, so that's three things. Those are the first three modules of this resilience training where we touch on those topics. And I don't know if any of them resonate. We'll go on to the rest, one at a time. And maybe if you're taking notes, whatever, you know, please, I want to hear what you're thinking and feeling right now. The fourth one is we do work through it, right? So we work through our suffering. Once we can see it as suffering, once we can face it, stop running, we can bear with it long enough to actually bring awareness to it and try to learn, then we can learn how to see through the apparent solidity or fixity of our suffering. We can learn to see what causes it, how it's reinforced, and how it can be deconditioned. Once we learn to see through it, then we can learn to work with it. That is to make subtle, to put effort into subtle changes, that choosing to invest less in the old habits that reinforce our reactivity and more in the new habits that are a little lighter and help us feel a little freer or a little more open or a little relief. That's the working through. And that's where mindfulness morphs into what most people call insight meditation or kindness meditation. It's both learning to see what is, to see things for what they are, but not just see through them, but to see what to do with them. Like I see through this, and I see that I need to actually stop thinking in this way about this pain and stop reacting in this way to it and start thinking in that way and reacting in that way to it. And then I'm going to be able to work through it. So it's the insight that helps us understand what to do with what we see in our minds that's harming us. And it's the kindness, the care, the skill, the art that allows us to slowly feel our way into, there must be another way to be with this, to work with this, to get through this way of feeling or way of thinking or way of identifying myself. So that's the first part of this training, which is really all about, as you can see, the basic foundation of self-healing in the Buddhist tradition. Those of you who know, have heard, a million Dharma talks, can recognize the Noble Truths and the Four Scopes of Mindfulness. I've taken some of the terminology, some of the labels away, but that's what it is. It's just the basis of Buddhist teaching. So then what? Right, we have some strategy. This may be a retreat strategy to start to work on facing how we feel, bearing with it, trying to see through it, trying to work through it, right? Little at a time. Then what? Well, there isn't just us in this equation, there's everybody else, right? And a lot of times, the thing that makes it very hard for us to, in the way we live, which is, as I mentioned, extremely unnatural. In the sense that, civilization, it's pretty much all artificial everywhere you look, right? But mostly it's unnatural because, this is maybe more true in the hot spots like New York, where you go outside and there's almost no trees, but there's millions of people. Now, of course, not so many, right? So the unnatural way we live is our environment is other people. And our environment is constructed by other people, or not necessarily people we see, but it's all human made, pretty much. And of course it's made out of nature and it's based on nature, so it's not like we're that far. But nonetheless, because we live in a way where our life is all about other people, our way of life is other people, we often really never get to work with ourselves because we're too busy bouncing off of other people. And as mammals, we're wired to do that. We come into the world, we're not interested in survival, we're interested in mommy, right? We have no clue about what survival would be other than mommy. So we come into this world and our primal drive is to love and be loved and belong to a relationship. And as a result of that, because our relationship is our lifeline, a relationship is also a death threat. Every time somebody gets mad at us or doesn't respond the way we want, we feel threatened and we feel triggered into trauma that, you know, we first experience when mommy has to go to the bathroom or mommy's having a bad day and doesn't smile at us and we feel like the world is coming to an end. Mommy hates me. I'm a terrible person. You know, I'll never be happy or whatever it is. So social stress, you know, bottom line is the second half of compassion training, the second half of CBRT, just as the second half of, you know, Nalanda Buddhism, the Nalanda tradition of Buddhism is all about compassion. It's all about our relationships and how do we embrace our relationships. Once we get a little clue about how to be with ourselves, how do we be with everybody else? So here are the some watchwords that I ridiculously absurd oversimplifications. Lisa's saying something about mother, and I apologize if it's not, if mother, if that's too gender specific. And I'm not sure what else, but I do want to read what you're saying, Lisa, but I'm going to hold the chat reading until the end of the, I don't have many more comments, but the end of these comments. So we need to start, I think, by accepting everybody. Like accepting what? Accepting that we're all human. Right? And our normal mind is biased, and we want to demonize, we want to idealize some people and cling to them, or some groups and cling to them as mine. And then we want to demonize other people and other groups as, you know, threatening, alien. And then everybody in between, because we're too busy surviving and all we need to know is what's going to save us or what's going to kill us, everybody in between we don't really pay attention to. They don't seem to matter, right? So that's the sort of way our minds, our social survival bias is to stratify or chunkify our relationships with other people and to transfer onto them biases in other groups as well. This isn't just a personal thing, this is social. And there are groups that become our identity groups and there are groups that become our outgroups. And this is how wars happen and this is how racism happens. And but it's totally tied into the way our mammalian minds are conditioned. So the first thing we need to know is we need to really kind of get real and like do one of those 23andMe DNA tests and realize that we're 99.9999% the same as everybody and the same as chimps too, by the way. That what makes us different is so minuscule that it's a joke and that to base a whole sense of reality on our differences is really psychotic. We don't do it because we're psychotic. We do it because we come into the world wired for survival. And we had to recognize those animals who were safe, if only because we had to come back to them or hear, recognize their voice to know when they were calling us. We had to do it. And like this is the way our minds work, and most cultures have built on that creating cultures of identity, egocentric or unilateral cultural identity. But we're trying here to break that down because the reality is, and we can see it now with the virus, we really are all in it together and we really are the same. So let's face reality. Like, and we're as we're all in it together, then the only tool that makes sense is that we treat everybody as a person, just like me, or mom or dad or whoever is the caregiver that we are grateful to. So yeah, we need to practice, and that's huge. It's not easy. It involves not just the psychology of building empathy, but it involves the social psychology of understanding, group psychology of understanding our identification and debiasing our minds in the many ways in which this primitive habit of picking favorites and shutting some people out has run most of our society, runs most of our institutions, and is profoundly threatening to all of us. And it isn't really tolerable anymore now that we live in a world where there is no out. We're all in, right? So we accept everybody. How do we do that? We practice unbiased empathy. And for those of you who know about equalizing practice or loving kindness with figures, the close, neutral, and far, that's what we mean. We practice exposing our biases to those who we love or we feel safe with, who we tend to cling to, those we feel threatened by, who we tend to fight with or want to fight with, and those who are neutral, who we want to ignore. And we monitor those biases and we start to deconstruct them. And once we start to deconstruct them, we can have genuine empathy. Instead of seeing our loved one as just a handy life support, we start to recognize who they really are and let them be free. Instead of judging our challengers or critics or the other people as, people that should be gotten rid of or people that shouldn't be, we start to realize they're just like us and we can learn a lot from them, and we've got to learn to deal with people that are different from us, because everybody, so many people are. And then we deal with the silent majority of the people we don't know. We have to learn to have empathy for them as real people who really matter, regardless of the fact that they neither threaten me or thrill me. They're just people. So when we have that equal empathy practice, we then begin to sort of recognize what's at the root of this. You know, what's as the poet T.S. Eliot wrote, who's behind, what are the hands that wove the intolerable shirt of flame that humankind cannot remove, right? That, what is made our internal predicament, our human predicament of feeling so trapped in our own mind or trapped in our relationships, and stressed by them? It's our self-habit, our survival-based self-protective instincts, our stress instincts, really, to use the Western language. And a lot of them are social stress instincts, right? That has to do with avoiding shame, which is the equivalent of an emotional or psychological or social death threat, right? But we have these instincts to protect ourselves way before we can think, speak, or before we're aware of them. And they run our emotional brains, and they continue to run our emotional lives until we go in and dismantle them. Because at the root of all these biases, there's I'm threatened, I'm alone. If I don't fight for my survival and cling to things, I'll be dead. I don't have the power to live. I'm not big enough, I'm not strong enough, I'm not smart enough. And that's actually really, maybe it was true when we were infants, we couldn't even roll over, but it doesn't stay true for very long. Like I have sons, one 14-year-old and one 16-year-old, and they're real human adults. They're real humans already, just a few years. Smart and capable. So that's what it means. Already when we're two, we're smarter than a lot of creatures. So we need to accept ourselves. So we need to accept everybody. We're all people, and we need to accept ourselves, because that's what's going to make us feel safe. Until we're able to really accept that I'm okay, really, I'm not in danger. Or if I am in danger, it's okay, because it doesn't mean anything personal about me. And that's where self-compassion comes in. And that's the practice we started with, is to really learn to be good mother to ourselves, or a good parent, good caregiver, whatever gender, whatever flavor, and hence to make us feel safe to live. And once we get that down, we get the I'm okay, I can be with myself, I can care for myself, then we can move on to taking more care of others, with others. And that's sort of the next principle, is to really learn to be able to care for everybody, right? Not just accept everybody, but to bring care to every interaction so that we make the most of it, whatever it is. And that's the practice of give and take, where we're taking an awareness of others and giving whatever we can to upgrade the interaction. And then finally, what's the future? Well, we have to become care, right? We have to become care become care yourself, right? We have to learn to embody the part of us that is the most capable and that is the most helpful, the least harmful. And that is our kindness and compassion. And that's the tool, since we're all in it together, the tool that's right for our lives is to feel all of us in it together. That's the tool of compassion. So that's actually the right tool for our lives. We should be in that mindset all the time. And now we know from modern positive psychology and neuroscience that if we're in that mindset all the time, we're going to live longer, we're going to heal better, we're not going to feel alienated or alone, we're not going to feel our lives are meaningless and purposeless. So let's get there, right? So that this is a my little retreat agenda, and I will there just shut up and open the floor to all of you to share what's been on your mind. How's this this crisis feeling to you, and what do you feel you want from our community, from others here, from Nalanda Institute, and so on. So please do remember now to go on your managed participants and raise your hand. And actually, in the meanwhile, while you're doing that, I'm going to look at the chats. Some of them really okay. Thank you. Good. So the chats I have, oh, there we go, are mostly technical. Okay. Great. Thank you. So your example of a mother doesn't account for infants and children whose mother could not form an attachment bond. Yeah. No, that's true. But we all have to have one living being. You know, the research in Kosovo after the wars there showed us that without some care, real present caregiver, loving and attending and doting over a little one, our brains just don't develop. And we can't even live. We don't even survive. So anyone want to share? Do I see any hands? I don't see any of the little hands. Nobody wants to share what's on your mind? And
Joe, I think Erin has her hand raised.
Okay, great. Okay, Erin, hold on, where are you? Hi, Erin. So I'm unmuting you, yeah? Okay, great. You should be, yeah.
I'm good now.
Great.
Yeah, for some reason, my reactions thing doesn't allow me to have the hand raised, but anyway, I'll just say a couple of things. So I'm sort of secluded out here. My spouse is in another state, and we kind of decided when I had the opportunity to go there to not out of an abundance of caution, and now we're like, oh, who knows when I'm going to get there. But what is keeping it sort of okay is that we both have jobs that are not on hold because of this. I mean, it's mandatory work from home, but we're both just busy. I mean, I've never had such a tremendous workload, except maybe when I finished my PhD, as I do right now. So what is so helpful to me is in light of your second, you know, point about what I would be interested in having from Nalanda is things like this. Honestly, I have a good community of friends who I connect with, and I've been teaching meditation a couple of mornings a week to my students, my university students, just as an extra, you know, not a class requirement, but let's just do a practice on Zoom a couple mornings a week for our sanity. But to have, you know, sort of people who are like my colleagues or my friends who I can practice with, who maybe aren't my friends, and you know, they're not the people I'm gonna like text when I'm like or whatever, that sort of thing. But that other kind of community that is, you know, is, and I know that the lunchtime meditations are like every day of the week now, but unfortunately there's like no way on Monday through Friday. So having something that's happening outside of those hours that's a really low, I don't know how to say it, a low stress on my schedule, but provides that kind of outlet is so, I'm so grateful for it. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Erin. And yeah, I mean, we certainly, we're very much thinking of how we can support all of us as a community and hopefully offering more meetings like these And we really just kind of want to also hear from people what, you know, what you would think. That is really helpful to hear, Erin. And I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts you want to share, but we're offering the free offerings in uncertain times. If you go to our website, and you'll see the little blue Buddha links you to a page where there are some free offerings. And actually this week, as a preview of coming attractions, the first class in our sustainable happiness program, Stop Surviving, Start Thriving, will be available online. And people can just view that at their own leisure. So that's one thing. But in terms of live gatherings, we are thinking about how we can offer more events like this on a more regular basis, because I agree, we all really need to feel more part than ever of something, you know, where we feel safe and connected. Anyone else want to speak up?
Joe, you're hearing from Eileen and Zamira.
Okay, I don't see them. Where are they? Hold on a second. Let me go. So, Eileen, where are you? Okay.
There's I'm Zamira. Here. I think you just unmuted me.
Okay.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I just wanted to sort of add on to Erin's suggestion about having more opportunities to connect with this community and maybe also ask for if there are like specific meditation recommendations that we could be doing on a given week that are just either good for, you know, grounding, or if we're offering meditations to other people, like ways to sort of prepare ourselves for being of service, that would also be really nice.
Great, great, great. Okay, so it's nice to see you, and you know, it's nice to see so many faces I'm seeing from all over the world too. Victoria from Spain, and Samira, you're from zooming in from California. I think I saw Maria Thorne here as well. And Erin, hello to you. So what kind of practices? Well, I mean, we did release the 10 of the sustainable happiness practices, which we hope, you know, kind of conform to the retreat agenda the tentative retreat agenda I just laid out. But in terms of you being present for others, I mean, first thing is you got to put on your own oxygen mask. So whatever does that for you, that you know best. And that might be a breath practice. It might be a visualization with a mentor that allows you to feel empowered as a caregiver, or supports you or encourages you, acts as a role model. But whatever grounds you is the best way to be present for others. But as you offer to others, I think really nowadays, you know, for resilience, self-compassion is the key, right? Because resilience is the opposite of stress, right? Stress is feeling threatened. And when we feel threatened, by definition, our nature turns rigid and we start grabbing hold of everything. And when we grab hold of everything, there's no room for us to learn, to reach out and connect, or to change. So when we're talking about resilience, we're talking about the ability to let go, to bounce back from stress. And, you know, all of those practices, like the basic mindfulness practices and basic compassion practices, are key. But the most important one for human beings, because the worst case for most of us is not death, it's exclusion, it's shame, rejection. That is by far, you know, and I think there's been some objective research showing this, but psychologically, that's what the Dharma would predict. That's what psychology says. And the best cure for that is, you know, self-compassion. And that our dear friend, Chris Kirmer and Kristen Neff have a beautiful formula for that we use a lot in some of our meditations. Tara Brock, obviously, also with RAIN. So for the, you know, just basic grounding in and kind of helping people bear what it is they're feeling, all of this sort of filtered stresses of disconnection, possible overwork or overwhelm, dread of mortality, all of these things. It's self-compassion for most people, not for everybody. And then I think the next important thing, once we feel, we can feel our own body again, because we feel like, okay, maybe I'm not dead yet, or I'm okay, I can accept myself, I can bear being with myself, then we want to remind ourselves how connected we are to other people. So the giving and taking, or just simple loving kindness. You know, loving kindness is beautiful for this. I want to close, if we have time, with the loving kindness practice. But, it's something anybody can do, as you all know, using simple phrases of affirmation. It also works because we're such verbal creatures that when we affirm something like, may I be happy or well, may you be happy or well, we stir up some of those warm feelings that we need. That's like medicine, and that medicine counteracts our isolation, which is probably the worst form of stress that we're all feeling right now. So those two, self-compassion and loving kindness, or some kind of compassion for others, giving and taking if people know it, or even mentoring if people feel a need to, if they're like on the front lines, or they need to be strong for someone else, mentor practices can be helpful. Okay? Is that helpful, Zamira? Yeah, okay, cool, thank you. And Eileen, where are you?
Hi, I can see me.
Yeah, good to see you, Eileen. How are you?
And I see Jerry. Hi, Jerry. Hi. So I'm sitting here with my left foot broken and the right one sprained.
Oh my God, how did that happen?
The timing. I did not slip on the sidewalk. I had these looks. I'm starting to get the gray hair, and they look at me. Did you fall inside, or did you fall? No, I was playing with a dog, and I jumped off a wall, and I landed badly. So, just want to be clear, I'm still alive.
Okay.
March 11th, and I've been, just a few days ago, got out of rehab, and
okay,
well, sort of a double whammy. You know, I can't go anywhere, and I can't go anywhere. I really can't go anywhere. And the offer to go to Vermont and have a whole house to myself, but my medical, I can't go anywhere. And yeah. I guess to shortcut over a lot of other things I could say, what I'm looking to Nalanda for is exactly this, is more of this. There's a sense of, and what meditation offers, and particularly the self-compassion practices offer, is, that sort of pushing out a sense of self that's not real, that terrible tension, and a crisis like this, the volume can go way, way, way up.
Yeah.
And it's not helpful to me. It's not helpful. And late at night when I can't hear the cars, I'm in the West Village, for Christ's sake, no cars, no traffic. And it's, I like that in the country. I don't like it here. So it's very disconcerting and very ungrounding, but you don't see the enemy. You don't see the problem. We're all just kind of doing this weird thing about this invisible thing. And so, community, and especially a community that is grounding and offering words like self-compassion and like-minded souls and so on is, a very big gift. So,
okay, well, thanks for letting us know, and may you heal quickly.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is so silly. If I could, I'd turn it around and show you. One big fat one and one little skinny one all bandaged up in a wheelchair. Oh. And,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll be up and about soon.
I'm sure. A few weeks.
Steph, did you want to share something?
Hi, everybody. Hi, Joe. Wanted to say thank you for doing this. I took your CBRT training when I was in Toronto, and I moved to Vancouver in December, and it's been kind of a rough ride to try to just, settle in Vancouver and then trying to make friends and not feel the loneliness, and then this hits. So it's been really interesting, but the practice that you've taught us has been, really helpful. And I just have a quick question. I don't know how many people on this chat this will apply to, but as far as being of service, I was wondering if you had any recommendations for meditation when somebody has a panic attack. One of my friends had a panic attack yesterday, and thank God I did this training with you because I was able to guide him through a meditation to ground him. But I'm not sure, you know, if that's the right, meditation to go through, or it's really hard when you're teaching over Zoom and over the phone because you can't really read language. Yeah. And you don't know if the person, like when they're off the phone, you don't know, are you still breathing? Are you still breathing to four with me? Or are you having more panic attacks on the other side of the phone? So just wondering about that. And, you know, just from leaving people in a safe space, I'm finding that sometimes I'm going to meetups online and we're doing some deep work, but I don't feel grounded at the end. And I don't know, any tips that you might have on that, given that we're sort of virtual at the moment?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Good luck out there. It's great to see you. First is about panic. I mean, very variable. It's difficult. You know, it depends on if somebody's in a full-blown panic attack. It's often very hard for them to have any presence of mind. So look good for you that you were able to get through to the person. If it's earlier in the escalation toward panic, obviously breathing, deep breathing, abdominal breathing can be helpful because it stimulates the vagal system, and it also just counteracts the part of the panic is the chest breathing. And that is, you know, anxiety-based, sympathetically driven, shallow breaths. So breathing in the abdomen can help with that, or just putting your hand on your abdomen or massaging your body somewhere just to create a sense of grounding. You know, again, depends on the psychology of the person. It can be very variable, but you just try things and see what sticks, and it sounds like that worked for you. I mean, I think that as far as the groundless feeling that we all have, it's fascinating. And we were on our contemplative psychotherapy group last night, and just talking about how different it is to be doing so much work over the phone or by Zoom. And there's just a feeling that something's missing, or is something's not quite right, or we have to try harder or whatever. And people find it exhausting in general, or some people actually like certain aspects of this kind of work, and it's not all good or all bad. But I think there's an element of that we're animals. I mean, most of the information that we process about our lives is not verbal, and it's not even visual. Even vision is a powerful sense, but we pick up on, you know, person's breath rhythm, on their body movements. There's a kind, maybe their pheromones are of some kind when there's somebody in the room. So there's something about the presence of another human being that grounds us in a way that nothing else can ground us. And I mean, you know, if it's a good connection, right? So not having access to that will make us feel like we're floating a little bit in the void. And that's a kind of isolation anxiety symptom. It's a little bit of an anxiety, like a generalized or a kind of a quasi panic or dissociative symptom, as we would say, to use the sort of medical jargon. And the remedy for that is to remember those people we're connected to try to call them to mind, envision them, hear their voice. I mean, it could be that you have another Zoom session, or you call somebody on the phone. Or it could be that you use your meditative practice and just envision a very powerful encounter with someone who gives you a very strong sense of groundedness and stability and connection. And then you might feel your awareness returning to your body because you're feeling safe and connected again. So you know, it's a social, you know, alienation symptom, and I suspect a lot of us are feeling it in different ways at this time. I don't know if there are other, someone is chatting, Monica, hi Monica. Someone is chatting that panic and anxiety are, do you want to say that? You don't want to say it, okay. Panic, and you don't want me to read it, Monica? A lot of people are having panic. And but what's the question at the end?
Lisa has been raising her hand for a while.
Lisa.
Okay. Very good. So let me see if I can find Lisa.
She's unmuted already, Joe.
Okay, Lisa, just speak up and then I'll try to find where I can see you, but at least I'll be able to hear you. There's a lot of, there's multiple screens.
There you go.
So there's a challenge because I have multiple screens.
Okay, yeah.
May not be able to see you.
Okay.
There we go. I think you're...
You can hear me, correct?
I can hear you.
Okay, good. I just want to say thank you to the meditation community of teachers who have just are swarming the internet in a good way. And I hope it stays this way because in the past, if you wanted access to folks like yourself, you know, you got to go to Copalo or Omega, or you got to buy the books, you got to sign up for the class. And sometimes you guys don't really even feel like real people, you know, because you're kind of like the big teacher with the books and the whole thing. And now all of a sudden you're like super accessible people and acknowledging, you know, you might've been doing this for 30 or 40 years and you're even going, holy shit, I need some new tools too. So I want to say, I appreciate the humility, the accessibility. And I hope that that, you know, can continue. For me, the single most beneficial aspect of this crisis is precisely this, which is to have such unparalleled access to all of you. And then I also have a barn in my backyard with three beautiful horses. So I'm kind of on a retreat and I do two or three of these programs a day. So it's huge. It's huge. It's like...
You already have your retreat agenda.
Yeah, it's big. Yeah.
And thank you for joining us and for sharing that. And I agree. I mean, I think this is one of the things about Zoom that we've used as a learning technology for a long time, but haven't really thought of it as a community gathering. And you see that it does have, you know, the potential for making it easier for all of us to come together and be accessible to each other is great. So yeah,
especially, I mean, for people who live in the boondocks, I mean, I'm an hour from my closest teacher.
Okay.
So now all of a sudden, like, she's on the Zoom and I'm like, oh my God, there she is. And I don't have to drive an hour in traffic. It's quite an open right now, but it's wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Okay.
I'll mute myself.
Thank you. Anyone else?
I'd like to share something, Joe, before you finish up.
Please do.
Let me just say that, first of all, I know we're almost done. I want to thank you, Joe, of course, for this remarkable teaching and for bringing us all together tonight. And I also want to thank the remarkable group of people, because many of you, I see your names on mailing lists, et cetera, and I've interacted with you in some kind of way. And to see your faces, as I think Lisa was saying, other people have said, it's amazing that we're all able to, there was over 100 of us tonight who were able to gather. And to me, in spite of all the shit outside, that we were able to come together and to see everybody, it just really brings a great amount of light into my life tonight. So I want to really thank the community, all of you. And I think the one message I'm getting from everybody is we need to do this more. And I feel that one of my jobs is to get a cattle prod and get Joe to get doing this more. So that's all, that's my message. I am gonna also put in the chat for everybody, I put it in earlier. If you have anything you want to feedback about tonight, suggestions for how we should move forward, et cetera, contact me and I will relay it to Joe, et cetera. But really, my main thing tonight is really to thank all of you tonight. Just seeing everybody has just been an incredible thing. So thank you, everybody.
Yes, and I want to thank Tom. And also, if you don't mind, Diane, I want to point out Diane Bertolo, his partner in crime.
Partner.
As our secret weapons for keeping things moving at Nalanda and keeping you all connected and keeping us together, Jerry and I. And so Diane, thank you too for joining us. It's great to see your face here. And Tom, thank you for coming out of hiding and offering your email to people. And yeah, I do think it's a powerful way for us to stay connected and grow as a community that we haven't really, you know, used or thought of using in this way. And so again, silver lining. Any other thoughts before we have a closing meditation?
There's a question where the meow is coming from, and that is Ginger.
Well, it's coming from Ginger, who one of our two cats, who whenever the door, I saw somebody else with a cat here this evening on Zoom. When there's a dog, hello, or is that a cat? Oh, hi, how sweet. That's like our Juniper. You know, whenever there's a door closed, you can count on Ginger to be at it going meow, meow. So that's that. And somebody else is bringing Kimberly. There's your little one. Okay, wonderful. There's Bella. Hi, Bella, how are you? Okay. So yes, that's, and Yvonne, hello. So yeah, no, this is one of the nice things about Zoom that someone was sharing on this contemplative psychotherapy meeting we had. It's just that you get to go take a step into everybody's life a little bit, and the kind of barrier, the kind of professional or other kind of official barrier between, you know, public and private is kind of a little, the veil is removed, as it were. You see the person behind the curtain, which is nice. And you even get to see, you know, some cats and dogs and or kids or you know, decor. So that does add to our ability to connect with people, which is, again, what helps us feel safe and alive. And so it's all good. So if there are no other questions, I will just close with a brief love and kindness practice.
Joe, I think there's one more question from Raphael.
Okay, Raphael.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, hi, how are you? Good to see you.
I was hoping for a moment that you guys wouldn't see my last minute question. I'm so happy to be here. I mean, here in my space and everyone's space also. By the way, Tom, I love your books, man. I want to be there. It's just like amazing. Are those all your books? I don't know.
things are not as they appear.
I agree. But it's been great to definitely be here. I do a lot of technology and as a tech specialist in education, but it's a good thing to kind of like be a part of it and not so much be behind the technology. And today I was able to coordinate with three coworkers, and it definitely felt great. Like I was able to experience a sense of connection, even though it was through Zoom. So I feel the same way here. I feel very safe. I feel very, you know, and Joe, you were talking about bias and how we have our own cliques and our own clinging and groups. For some reason, I feel very, very comfortable seeing so many different faces and so many different people. And Jerry, you look so comfortable in that sofa. I'm gonna have to visit your home at some point. I know that we gotta run, but Friday of last week, I had a trigger, you know, where this whole I had this moment where this thing became very solid. This story became very solid. I had this moment of trauma that actually just took hold of me for basically the whole week until probably last night, and. Joe, you were talking about finding a moment of where you go into awareness and you can sort of like, you know, create like a distance between that trauma experience. And I had emailed you previously, and one of the things that I do is that I have all of your recordings here that I've compiled over the courses. And I always find that when I'm triggered like that, doing mindfulness right away doesn't allow me to kind of like separate myself. But when I do an awareness, I forget the name of it, when I do one of the awareness, it does allow me to come back. But anyway, thank you so much for all of those opportunities and to all of you who are out there somewhere. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Raphael. It's great to hear you and to hear that you're using the tools and relieving some of the pressures that we all are facing. So yeah, And it's also great that you get
all here. Yeah, you can't see them, but they're all here.
That's okay.
Oh,
you get to experience Zoom as a human rather than a technician. That's really important.